The Closing Market Report is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming on AM 580 as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at agrigold.com.
Welcome to the Closing Market Report for Tuesday, November 21st, 2006. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. In agricultural news, the GOP may let Democrats set the FY2006 federal agricultural budget. Also, a South Dakota company is building a cellulosic ethanol plant, and U.S. beef exports to Russia are resuming. I'll have details of these and other stories shortly. Also this half hour, an in-depth interview with a spokesperson at the Renewable Fuels Association on the future of ethanol. And Don Day will be by with agricultural weather. It's all on the Tuesday edition of your Closing Market Report.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Tuesday afternoon, prices settled like this in Kansas City. December wheat, 5.14¾, down a quarter. March, 5.31, up 3½. At the Board of Trade in Chicago, December wheat, 4.79¾, up 4¾. March, 5.01¾, up 8. May, 5.02½, up 8½. December corn, 3.61¼, up 1¼. March, 3.77¼, up 2¼. May, 3.80¼, up 2¾. Red line December, 3.45½, up 4¼. January soybeans, 6.73, up 5½. March, 6.86¼, up 6¼. May, 6.95¼, up 5¼. Novice, 7.14¼, up 6. December soybean meal, 1.92, up 10. December soybean oil, 28.88, up 16. At the Merck, January feeders, 98.77½, up 110. December live cattle, 87.87½, up 45. December lean hogs, 62.35, up 30 on the day. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. Good morning, Wayne.
Well, good afternoon, Dave. What a beautiful day over here. It looks like it's going to be nice for the rest of the week, and we're starting to see a few combines running back in the field this afternoon.
I said it was morning because it was the opening bell that we had some activity, any activity, and then we didn't have any all day long until, well, the closing bell, essentially.
But we just participated in bell time, didn't we? They had to wake us up with one bell or the other bell. No, it was very, very quiet, you know, as we were discussing before we come on the air here. When we talked to anybody on the floor, is anything going on? And they'd say, no. It was a very quiet day with very little activity. Just trying to lead up and set up the cards a little bit for how we were going to have option expiration, I think, was the one thing. And it was questionable for a little while whether they were going to close the corn above or below the 60 by just a little bit. And we looked over at the CRB, and we looked at the crude oil, the heating oil, and the unleaded gas, and it wasn't a very hard decision. The energies pulled us on up, didn't they?
And we also had option settlements for the December contract off the board in both the wheat as well as the meal and oil. Did they play into the markets today at all?
Well, sure. As the oil was going up, of course, bean oil being considered an energy here now, basically the bean oil stayed up strong. That's what kept the beans strong most of the day. You know, as we closed up 16.28.88, basically, on the December oil, hanging in there strong, and basically a 1.92 close, just pretty much unchanged, only up 10 cents on the meal. The wheat, hey, the December wheat was up a nickel, 79¾, quarter of a cent from one of the strike prices. So they'd love to settle around them strike prices, don't they, Dave?
They sure do, and more or less they're more likely to do than not do, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, they want to look and see what's going to come out and go to those things so we can see whether we can play the little game as to if we've got one we want to exercise or not, this afternoon, and also as to let a lot of those expire worthless if at all possible.
So who was in the picks buying at the end? Was it spec or was it locals or a combination?
I'm not 100% sure who was there, but I'm going to guess it was some of the locals that sold it early, and also a few people that were evening up that maybe were looking at the idea that they did have some options that they'd want to cover quite towards the close.
What do you look for the rest of the week? We have a short day tomorrow, Thanksgiving, no trade, a short day on Friday.
Well, you know, seasonally, we generally see a little bit of a pop now into Friday. But we're going to have a lot less people in the pit or in Chicago here probably tomorrow and Friday. So we could see more exaggerated gains or losses just because all the players aren't going to be there, Dave. But definitely somewhat of a solid close today. So technically, we have to say, steady to probably a little better. But all in all, holiday trade. And that's why we come into the office on those days, even though we'd think it's going to be quiet.
Was it equally quiet at the Merck today?
At the Merck, well, we saw some pretty good activity over in the cattle and the hogs, both being higher, the feeder cattle being higher. Some news that we were going to be opening up some exports back to Russia again. I think they have to inspect a plant. Or two, and then after that, why we're able to do that. The gold and the silver, moving their way on up today also, and the energies, as we talk about that, crude oil back above $60, big gains for the holiday driving and the gasoline up over 6 cents today.
Just in time for Thanksgiving, huh?
Just in time, we saw some real excitement over on that side. The CRB closing up 402 points, that basically tells us that I think the guys looked at that all day long, and they said between that and the energies why we were going to close higher rather than lower on the day.
Do you follow some of the other indexes, the S&P or the Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, we watch the S&P, the Dow, and basically the CRB. Dow hanging right in there. It's just down 3, and the S&P just slightly lower. It was the CRB is the one that they've seen been watching with the grains a lot lately and paying a lot of attention to.
Well, all along we've been saying, well, most of our analysts have been saying, on the cash side, if you need some cash sales, go ahead and sell at these levels. I don't suppose you would say any different today.
I think that you made the first mark. Part of it was good. If you need some cash flow, if you're coming out of the field right now, cash sales, How can you say you're going wrong when you're selling close to $3.50 corn out of the field? We see no problem in cash flow sales being made. Along the way, we, as I said this morning, we feel that the prices will probably be higher in the spring, but they've also peaked or went up faster in the fall here than we thought they would for things later. So, things can always change. That's why it's a futures market, and we don't know for sure what's going to happen down the road. But, for some cash flow needs, nothing wrong with making a few sales. But don't get overexcited about making the sales now because we think there will be better prices.
Thanks, Wayne.
Thanks, Dave.
Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. He is in New Market, Indiana.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from Risk Management Commodities, with offices in Chalmers and Lafayette, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities provides commodities analysis and recommendations for business and agriculture throughout East Central Illinois and Western Indiana. For information, call 866-837-9027.
At the bottom of the hour, meteorologist Don Day will be in for a look at agricultural weather, taking a look at AM 580 Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser's two-state forecast today. In the north, partly sunny, elsewhere mostly sunny, highs ranging from 48 to 58 degrees tonight. Clear to partly cloudy, lows ranging from 25 in eastern Indiana to 35 degrees in west central Illinois. And then tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs ranging from 50 to 4 degrees in northern and eastern Indiana to 62 degrees in southwestern Illinois. In agricultural news, there's increasing talk in Congress that Republicans will not finalize the current year of agricultural appropriations in the lame duck session and instead pass a continuing resolution that would give Democrats final say on spending. Also under consideration is one or a series of omnibus bills to deal with the nine appropriation measures still on the table. Incoming House Ag Chair Colin Peterson.
If I had to guess today, when we get back there December 5th or 6th, whatever it is, I would not be surprised to see them do a CR into next year and basically punt the whole thing to us. I think that is a very definite possibility, but it's their call.
Many Democrats favor pay-as-you-go spending in the next fiscal appropriation. Under PAYGO rules, any new mandatory spending would require Congress to cut a similar amount of spending for current mandatory programs or to raise taxes to ensure that the national debt does not grow larger. Leaders and ministers from 21 Asian and Pacific Rim nations and U.S. Trade Representative Susan Schwab met over the weekend in Vietnam to discuss global trade. Sources say that some U.S. officials are examining whether ethanol makes subsidies for corn unnecessary. It's looking like corn producers have little desire to put expiring CRP acres back into production. Preliminary data from USDA reports that of the 16 million acres scheduled to come out of the program in 2007, producers will likely re-enroll 13 million acres back into the CRP program. Still, sources at USDA say many farmers with contracts that expire next year have yet to sign on the CRP dotted line. A South Dakota company says it plans to build the first commercial-scale cellulosic ethanol plant in the U.S. Mike Lockram is with Brewing Companies. He says the plant will use corn stover as well as a kernel.
Our project plan is to take a 50-million-gallon plant in the state of Iowa that's corn to ethanol. We're going to include a cellulose to ethanol component to that. We're going to take that plant from 50 million gallons a year to 125 million gallons a year. Our feedstock on the cellulose is going to be the corn stover. So not only are we going to take the corn from the farmer, we're going to take the corn stover, and it's going to involve our proprietary technology, BFRAC, in which we fractionate the corn.
Lockram says the process will allow the plant to make 11% more ethanol from a bushel of corn and 27% more from an acre of corn, while cutting the need for fossil fuel by 83% by using corn byproducts for power. And the U.S. and Russia have signed a deal that will allow resumption of beef trade to Russia, ending a three-year ban. Russia will accept boneless, bone-in, and beef byproducts from cattle under 30 months of age. Russia also agreed to bone fragment tolerance levels. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. The Renewable Fuels Association reports that U.S. ethanol production is on pace for 20% growth in 2006. The RFA's latest projections estimates the U.S. will produce nearly 4.7 billion gallons of ethanol by year's end. I recently sat down with RFA spokesperson Mike Lockram to discuss the future of biofuels. Why don't you start out by telling us where we are in terms of plants online, number of plants under construction, capacity of ethanol production at the moment?
You know, nationally, I think right now we're at about 110 plants that are online. I think there's probably over 50 that are under construction. Construction sometimes varies in those numbers depending on what people consider as moving dirt or putting concrete in the ground. So you'll see varying numbers, but generally it's over 50, which that 50 alone is going to bring online, I think, just over 4 billion gallons in the next 2 to 3 years. But the plants currently online, we're probably up near about, I think we're projected to be about 12 billion gallons in the next 2 years total. So that would probably leave us at about 8 or 9 billion gallons right now.
Some of the new plants are larger. They're 100 million gallons or bigger. And I'm wondering, why these later plants are of a larger variety?
You know, that's a very good question, and I work for a company, Brewing Companies, out of Sioux Falls, where we don't build larger plants. Our business model just finds that the most efficient plants are about 50 to 60 million gallons per year, but that's not to say that those companies that are building the million-gallon plants aren't finding an efficient way to do business. But our business model has allowed us to, as we say, we don't necessarily build the biggest, but we believe we do build the most efficient plants in the nation, and that 60 gallons allows us for the right type of margins. It also allows us to control the radius in which we're going to get our corn and keep it more towards the local farmer and the local investor. So I can't speak specifically to the larger plants, but I can tell you more about our size plants and how we operate.
A few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, a 40 million gallon ethanol plant was sort of a standard model. Is that plant going to have a competitive disadvantage in the next 4 years as ethanol continues to ramp up?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and I think what people should realize is that, you know, those plants at 40 million gallons, their future lies in the technology that was put into them and how the companies built them. So we've certainly built some 40 million gallon plants at Broin, but we built those with the type of technology and the type of engineering that is going to allow us to expand those rather easily at a fairly reasonable cost, so we're not going to put the plant into a big financial impact, but then to move it up to about a 50 or 60 million gallon plant. So the standalone plants that were built at 40 millions could possibly be at a slight disadvantage, depending on the area and what the competition brings into them. But again, if they're able to expand through their engineering and the technology, they'll survive just fine.
Get a little specific and tell me some of the things that you've done in the 40 million gallon model that will allow for expansion.
Well, we generally build what's called just a centerline. We call our centerline engineering process. So really everything's right down the middle of the plant, so you can expand it on either side. So when I say specifically, the ability to bolt on bigger tanks or the ability to add tanks, ability to add hammer mills is already in that design, so it makes it a real simple and easy process. We're not knocking down walls to put new walls up. We're just moving walls out so that we can make a bigger plant. It sounds pretty simple, and actually it is pretty simple. But then also some of our technology that we've been able to utilize in our plants, our BPX, and mostly our BPX. We also patented a fractionation, but BPX is a raw starch hydrolysis that has allowed us to produce higher yields per bushel as well. So even though we might have a center plate 40 million gallon per year plant, it's probably operating at close to 50 million gallons already. But then if we're able to expand it easily, we're going to get that plant up to about 60 million gallons.
National Renewable Fuel Standard is 7.5 billion gallons. Is a new renewable fuels standard necessary?
I think it would be very important. You know, I think we're just really starting to understand the capacity to which we can produce ethanol in this country. I don't know if anybody can pinpoint the exact number that we'll be at, say, by 2025. So I think a continuous evaluation of where that renewable fuels standard sits and the ability to move that up and get the country to where it needs to be with renewable fuels is very important.
What kind of number do you think, then, for a new renewable fuel standard?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and you hear a lot of different numbers out there right now. In fact, I heard a number that by 2025, you know, somebody's estimated that we can build or that we can produce 25 billion gallons just off corn. So I'm not sure. I think people have a general idea. I probably wouldn't be the one to necessarily comment on that exact number. You'd probably want to talk a little bit more to the RFA about that. But I think the number is still growing as we talk today.
When you reach about 10 billion gallons of ethanol, you've more or less reached the point where you've got the oxygen standards replacement for MTBE. And at that point, ethanol has to be looked at as how it is blended and whether or not oil companies will buy in to an idea of E85, market share, pump locations, and so on and so forth. From your point of view, what are the challenges in moving ethanol above MTBE replacement?
I think the first thing is getting the car manufacturers involved. I mean, I know the car companies are working really hard at getting flex fuel vehicles out on the road and things like that. But at the same time, you know, the study to show exactly, I think, as you're referring to, what is the most optimal blend in the cars that are made today to be as efficient as what gasoline might be. So I think the car manufacturers are taking a hard look at how to build their engines, what the technology will be in those engines. And I think once that gets solved, I mean, if you look back at what the blends are, you know, we talk about E10 from an emission standard. E85 was really just a number, I think, to offset M85, which was created out in California. So that true scientific study to say what's the most optimal blend in the ethanol industry really hasn't been done yet. And that's going to be the industry and the car manufacturers and frankly, getting Washington involved too. But once the car manufacturers and the people and those people come back and say, you know what, this is what's going to work. This is the engine that's going to make it work. This is the emissions level that we're going to operate at. I think it'll be a big step forward.
So in the chicken or egg question, you think it's got to be the car manufacturers before the oil companies?
I think the car manufacturers can set the tone, yes. I think the oil companies will ultimately buy into what the car manufacturers want to do. And so I think that's where the leverage is going to come for this industry, is to develop the automobile that's going to run optimally on whatever blend of ethanol is determined to be best. And, you know, because I think as consumers in this country, what you hear the most of is, where can I get it? And I lose gas mileage. And, you know, if I'm a consumer purchasing E85, yeah, those are going to be concerns of mine. Now, I do it as a person in the industry. I have a flex fuel vehicle that runs E85, and I do it because it's better for the environment, and it is better for your engine, too. So, I mean, there is some things already that make it worthwhile to put in your automobile, but the general consumer wants to know what the gas mileage is going to be and what the cost and where can I get it. And I think that comes back to the car manufacturers getting significantly involved.
Ethanol currently enjoys some advantages in that it has some tariff protections, it has some government subsidies for production. How much longer do you think that those need to be in place before ethanol can be up and running on its own without any kind of price supports?
Well, I think what's important to realize here is that I think even the oil companies necessarily aren't up and running on their own. The oil companies have been receiving tax breaks for the better part of 100 years. In fact, industries all throughout America have received some sort of tax breaks or incentives, whether it's in their inception or all the way through what their current state is right now. So the ethanol industry isn't any different. And those incentives are going to continue to be important. And whether they continue as incentives or they get lumped in as tax breaks, it is going to be something that's going to be necessary to keep the industry thriving.
So you see it as a long-term need?
Yes, absolutely. I do believe it's going to need to be a long-term name. Just like I said, just the same as any other industry in America right now.
A lot of talk about cellulosic ethanol, and the question centers how viable are corn-based ethanol plants in the long term. What are your thoughts regarding the corn window? In fact, is there a corn window? A lot of people we talk to say 4, 5, 6 year window, and then we're looking at cellulosic heavily.
Well, I think first of all, there's always going to need to be a place for corn to ethanol production. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I can tell you about what we're doing at Brewing Companies. We are involved in the cellulose to ethanol production technology right now. And what we're going to do as a company is that we are going to actually convert our corn to ethanol facilities to include a cellulose to ethanol. Our model is going to show that it's going to continue to keep the corn to ethanol facilities in production at a higher rate, because we're going to expand them to include the cellulose as well. So they're going to be parallel facilities.
Renewable Fuels Association spokesperson Mike Lockram.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, and equal housing lender.
With this look at AM 580 News, I'm Tom Rogers. The main provider of phone service in the city of Champaign wants to expand its services to include video, and city council members will consider that request tonight. AT&T plans to package on-demand video along with phone and high-speed internet service, but the company says it does not want to sign a franchise agreement like the current cable provider, Insight Communications. One councilman also says he has problems with the hardware that AT&T would have to install. Champaign County board members vote tonight on whether to ask the state to exempt the county nursing home project from potentially costly fines. New rules that took effect in September require the county to seek additional approval for cost overruns. But County Board Vice Chair Steve Beckett says the old rule should apply to the nursing home, where construction was nearly completed, but problems with the heating and air conditioning system and with mold boosted the cost. Beckett also says if the state sticks by its rules, the home may not open for several more months. A prominent Indianapolis doctor has died in a small plane crash in Iroquois County in Illinois. Dr. Larry Davis was a forensic psychiatrist who worked with the Indiana University School of Medicine. Authorities say Davis was returning from a business trip from Ottawa, Illinois, when his plane went down east of Cisna Park. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says Iraq War veteran and former congressional candidate Tammy Duckworth will be an effective advocate for the state's veterans. Governor Blagojevich has appointed Duckworth to head the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. Blagojevich says he picked Duckworth because of the work she's done speaking out on behalf of soldiers who are returning home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The director of the Indiana Department of Natural Resources is stepping down. Kyle Hupfer says he's taking a job as a general counsel for the Indianapolis Natural Gas Marketing Company. Governor Mitch Daniels has appointed a replacement. He's Robert Carter, Jr., who's now the DNR's director of law enforcement. And the man who founded Wildlife Prairie State Park in central Illinois has died. The Peoria County coroner says William Rutherford Sr. was 91 when he died today at his home in Peoria. Rutherford was an entrepreneur who built Wildlife Prairie Park to showcase animals native to Illinois. Rutherford signed the park over to the state in 2000. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Bunge North America in Danville. Bunge recognizes the importance of agricultural production to our society and economy and the role producers and processors play in providing food and feed to the world.
Don Day is away from his desk. He's in actually in New York today. But we have some agricultural weather courtesy of Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. For Brazil, he says that rain is still expected in all crop areas of the nation at one time or another in the next 2 weeks. He says there's no reason for serious concerns over dryness, although there is still a pocket of dryness in western Sao Paulo and neighboring areas of northern Paraná and southern Mato Grosso do Sul, as well as southwestern Minas Gerais. The dry pocket area should get a couple of opportunities for timely rain to help prevent dryness from becoming an issue in the week ahead. In Argentina, showers will begin to pop up Thursday and Friday, but their distribution will be restricted initially. Rain will become more widespread during the weekend, and it should wind down on Monday. Sufficient rain will fall to maintain a fair amount of crop moisture to support normal plant development and field progress in the coming week. Rain should fall in the drier areas of both Cordoba and Santiago del Estero to help improve planting prospects. In the U.S. Delta and Southeast, rain will spread from eastern Georgia to Virginia today, and we're looking for some heavy rainfall and flooding in eastern areas of the Carolinas, where 3 to more than 6 inches of rain will fall from today through Thursday. The Delta will be mostly dry through the weekend, and we'll see light showers early next week. The showers will spread into the southeast by the middle of the week. There is a fair chance of a second storm system of size possibly impacting the southeastern states during the final days of November or early December. In China, rain was most significant south of the Yangtze River on Monday. Meanwhile, in the Yellow River Basin, including the drought-stricken areas where it has been dry since early September, it's potential that we might see some rain. Moisture did actually fall in that area, with 2/10 to 3/4 of an inch likely, and having fallen in the Yellow River Basin. Rainfall further south will range from 1 inch to 2 inches and be locally more heavy. And then finally in Australia, we see that very warm to hot weather continues across the nation through the coming weekend, with daily highs remaining in the upper 80s and 90s, extremes above 100 degrees in interior portions of the nation. Sorghum and cotton will be most significantly stressed by the heat and dryness, while winter wheat, barley, and canola will be harvested aggressively. Remember, this evening we'll be at the Best Western Motel in Monticello, Illinois, for another one of our free AM 580 Agricultural Outlook panels. The meeting gets underway at 7:30 Central Time. There is no cost for the meeting. Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Commodities, Bill May of Roach Ag Marketing, Mike Zuzolo of Risk Management Commodities, and Steve Schilling from Strategic Farm Marketing on hand to answer your questions. And that is today's closing market report. Be sure to tune in tomorrow morning at 8:49 Central Time for our first look at the markets. This is Dave Dickey.